across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there. We really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us here at the Nolan Show. So what's this all about? We're hearing in the news this vote which was put in place for MLAs to sign off on post-Brexit trading rules. Enda McClafferty could explain this to us. He's our political editor. What's this all about, Enda?
Well, Stephen, under Article 18 of the Windsor Framework, there was what was called the Democratic Consent Mechanism. Now, this was first installed way back in 2020 during Boris Johnson's time in Number 10. And this was essentially to give politicians in Northern Ireland a say over the new rules and regulations which were going to apply only in Northern Ireland and not in other parts of the UK. So essentially what it was said back then was that politicians here would get a vote on whether these new post-Brexit trading arrangements should continue beyond first 4 years. And that's what we're seeing being played out now. So essentially what has to happen here is that the Secretary of State has to notify the Speaker and the First and Deputy First Ministers to begin this process. The First and Deputy First Ministers are then required to bring forward a motion before the 1st of December, which would allow MLAs to vote on whether or not to continue with the post-Brexit trading arrangements. Now, if they fail to do that within the space of a week, then an individual MLA can trigger that process. So that is going to happen, Stephen. Whoever triggers it, there's going to be a vote and a motion brought before the Assembly before the 17th of December. And then, of course, MLAs will decide on it. And as we know, controversially, it will require a simple majority, no cross-community support in terms of the vote needed for this one. So when we do get that majority, and judging by the fingers, we will get that majority, then what will happen then is that the Speaker will notify the Secretary of State, who then will notify the EU of the result.
Things like what in Northern Ireland are they signing off again?
Well, basically what this applies to are Articles 5 to 10 of the Windsor Framework, Stephen. And these basically are parts of the framework under which Northern Ireland applies regulations relating to the EU single market. As we know,
but spell it out to me in terms of everyday life and things like what that are happening in Northern Ireland that maybe we don't realise what they are.
Well, we know what they are, Stephen, in terms of the regulations around what can and cannot come into Northern Ireland, what needs to be checked for in case it's travelling on to within the EU and the Irish Republic. We know those restrictions are in place about what we can and cannot bring in here. We know, of course, there's other issues around pets. We know that's an issue for many people out there as well. There's lots of pieces of legislation that would apply. But for a lot of people in Northern Ireland, they may not have noticed it because the full-blown, I suppose, implications of all of this have not been put in place because of various arrangements that have been negotiated.
Why did the DUP sign off on a majority vote? Why didn't they insist it was cross-community?
Well, it wasn't for the DUP to sign off on this, Stephen. This was negotiated between the UK and the EU back in 2020, and then it was installed as well in the Windsor Framework brought forward by Rishi Sunak. So it wasn't for the DUP to sign off on this. This was something that was brought together, created, if you like, between Brussels and London.
And look, I'm clearly confused then. That glossy brochure that Sir Geoffrey Donaldson was waving around saying this is a good deal, was this not part of it? No?
No. This was already in place, Stephen. This had previously been negotiated and it was already there set in stone. So this wasn't part of the Safeguarding the Union document which Sir Geoffrey Donaldson negotiated with the government. This was always going to happen, regardless of what the DUP agreed with the UK government, because this was beyond the reach of those talks.
So that's really helpful. And the thank you, TUV leader MP Jim Allister with us. Morning to you, Jim.
Good morning.
Good morning. And the Alliance MLA Owen Tennyson. Good morning, Owen.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So, end up being very helpful there, Jim. This was your British government, your sovereign parliament, that decided to do this. So, the DUP's not at fault, right?
Well, the DUP's at fault in this sense, that they agreed to go back into a Stormont that would operate on this basis. And this is the most singularly significant vote there's been in 100 years in Northern Ireland, because for the first time, it asks locally elected representatives to abandon their lawmaking powers in 300 areas of law, which govern our agri-food industry, which govern much of our economy, which governs how we trade, how we make our goods, how we sell our goods, vital issues that touch upon every aspect of our economy. And what this vote is saying is that for the next 4 years or more, MLAs who have those responsibilities, who were elected to make laws in those areas, should abdicate those to a foreign parliament that no one elects from here, and that not even knowing what those laws will be, we have no idea what the laws will be in the next 4 years, but that we should surrender sovereignty over making those laws blindfolded to a foreign parliament.
But of course it's not surrendering sovereignty, because your sovereign parliament agreed to this.
Sorry, it's surrendering the lawmaking powers which are bestowed in the Assembly on many of these areas. It is MLAs sent to Stormont to make laws for their constituents, surrendering to a foreign parliament that they don't elect the right to make laws over this great conglomerate of issues. That's what it means. And that is so undemocratic. I just struggle to understand how any elected politician could put their hand up, so to speak, to surrender the powers to make the laws that they were mandated to make when they stood for election.
Well, Owen Tennyson, will your party be voting for this?
We will be supporting continuation of the winter framework, Stephen, and that's for a number of reasons. First of all, it's the only way to uphold our dual market access, whereby we have unfettered access both to the UK and European markets. It is essential in order to uphold the Good Friday Agreement and also to give businesses the certainty and stability that they need about the future trading arrangements that will be in place, because not to allow these arrangements to continue would be a leap into the dark. We warned in 2016, Stephen, as I have said many times on your show, that Brexit would throw up new borders and barriers and that it would be a near impossible circle to square. The Windsor Framework, whilst imperfect, is as good an attempt as there has been in the past 8 years to do that. And so I think there's an onus on those who are opposing this and creating a full fight effectively to actually set out what their solutions and alternatives are. This is not about surrendering sovereignty. It's about recognising that we live in an internationalist, outward-looking and interconnected world. And if we're going to have a strong and vibrant economy, we have to pool sovereignty with our nearest neighbours in order to ensure that we have access to that market. If you look at laws that have been coming through the Windsor Framework Democratic Scrutiny Committee since the Assembly came back, it's clear that many of those are absolutely essential. For example, for the car manufacturing industry, in order to ensure that there is access across the European market, but ultimately, actually, major markets often align their regulations more broader than that anyway, because we live in an internationalist society and we rely on trade for a strong economy. So I think Jim is burying his head in the sand. He refuses to recognise the reality of the world that we now live in, and also has no alternative to square the Brexit circle that he and others created.
Is that you schooled, Jim?
Certainly not. Let's be very clear. I can understand that Mr. Tennyson doesn't want, because of the embarrassment, to face the fact that he is now a colonialist. He wants Northern Ireland to be ruled as a colony by laws we don't make and can't change, laws that are made by a foreign jurisdiction. Now, it may be a surprise to some that the Alliance Party are now the colonialists of Northern Ireland along with the SDLP and Sinn Féin, but that's the reality. He talks about the Belfast Agreement. The Belfast Agreement was built upon the sacrosanct nature of the cross-community support for anything significant. And here comes the protocol with its proposition to leave Northern Ireland governed by the EU laws, and the first thing it does is repudiate a cross-community vote, and put us, in the first time in over 50 years, into a majoritarian situation on a most significant issue. Obviously, Owen's attachment to the Belfast Agreement is pretty flexible. If he can, at a stroke, abandon its most fundamental principle, that of cross-community support on anything controversial or anything of great significance, such as this is. So, you know, and it's ironic that I should be the one defending that principle of cross-community support, but that's the way it is. And that cross-community support was removed at the behest of the EU to the cheers of the Alliance Party and others, because they are the colonialists who want to be ruled by laws we don't make and can't change.
Stephen, I think people will see through the theatrics and the theatrical language on this one. I mean, look, Jim has been very clear about his opposition to the Good Friday Agreement since 1998. He's been very open about the fact
that you're now the opponent.
He doesn't want the institutions of that agreement to operate. And I think people are tired of this soap opera around Brexit and want politicians actually focusing on the issues that really matter in terms of working together in the Assembly to build a vibrant economy, to invest in our education and health services, and to deal with the cost of living. And that's what we're there to do, and that's what we need to focus on.
And to hand away powers over our economy.
Jim is addicted to drama, to chaos, to crisis, to instability, and I don't think that's where most people are.
Ah, you've got some new lines, Owen. Very good.
Where was the cross-community consent for Brexit in the first place? You can't now demand that there's cross-community consent for the post-Brexit.
It was a national issue. There's no parallel with the national referendum and the operation of Stormont. No parallel whatsoever. Stormont's supposed to operate on cross-community, and here it is abandoned.
I didn't interrupt you, Jim. And it would be good manners for you to allow me to finish. There was no call from the DUP or from Jim Allister in 2016 that there would need to be cross-community protections to leave the EU. So they can't now call for those protections to be in place.
Let him finish. Hold on.
The cross-community consent issue only applies to certain devolved issues. And the irony is that cross-community votes are actually the least cross-community of any vote in the Assembly. Because the votes of Alliance of People Before Profit and previously the Greens would count for less. So Jim isn't interested in democratic consent. He's interested in a veto and democracy on his terms. And I don't think that is sustainable. And it speaks entirely, Stephen, to the arguments that we've been making about the need for fundamental reform of our institutions to ensure that they can actually deliver and represent everyone in our society.
And what Jim Allister, the DUP, got built into the Safeguarding the Union document that I referred to with Enda this morning, it says, if a vote is passed on a simple majority only, the government will be under a statutory duty placed on it as a consequence of this package to initiate a timely independent review of the operation of the framework and to ensure its report is laid in Parliament and considered fully, including in discussion between the UK and EU. So the DUP got that protection drilled in, didn't they?
Well, they got no reversal of the fundamentals. They got a promised review, and I think we all know in politics that reviews are whatever government want them to be. But, you know, let me deal with the legal issue here. Owen says this has nothing to do with cross-community. Sorry, this vote, other than the fact that the law had to be changed to avoid it being cross-community, would have been cross-community. They had to change the law to remove the cross-community consent. Why did they do that? Because they knew that unionists, rightly, would object to being governed by foreign laws they don't make and can't change. So in order to guarantee its approval and success for the colonialists, they had to remove the cross-communities consent.
So how is this affecting people's lives this morning? And how will it affect their lives ongoing?
Well, let me just take a few examples. Article 5.4 of the protocol introduces Annex 2 of the protocol, which has 300 areas of law where it's EU law that governs.
Try to leave out annexes and this and that. Just tell us how it's going to affect our lives.
300 areas of law. Let me give you a few examples. Anything that governs our agri-food industry is now EU law, not British law. Anything that governs how we manufacture and produce, sell, package our goods is EU law. But the most fundamental change that it makes is the one that puts Northern Ireland under the EU's customs code, which then operates on the basis that GB is a foreign country, that therefore you must have an international border between GB and Northern Ireland. And that is what one of the laws that will be endorsed by this vote in December to continue with the ridiculous situation that GB is treated as a foreign country and we must have an international trade border between us and them. And the other factor to remember is that it's no coincidence that all these 300 areas of law are the identical laws which apply in the Irish Republic because they're in the EU. We're subject to EU laws. So you can see from a unionist perspective how rightly we fear that that is building the all-Ireland economy, and that's what it's meant to do. And, of course, in all those areas, we should be subject to laws we make ourselves within the United Kingdom, not foreign laws.
Owen, can you understand his fears?
Well, look, I understand the frustration of many unionist voters out there, Stephen, who were told by their leaders in 2016 that Brexit would be sunlit upland, that we could leave the European Union and have all of the benefits of EU membership without any of the obligations. But I don't understand how someone like Jim has managed to tie himself in knots and walk himself to this position. In terms of the divergence issue between Northern Ireland and GB, we now have a Labour government who's been very clear that they want to seek a closer relationship with the EU and want to align in a number of those areas. That will have a benefit for Northern Ireland in that it will reduce the friction in the IRC. And from our perspective in Alliance, we would want to go further and see the entirety of the UK back in the single market and the customs union, which is the surest way to solve this issue and finally remove that friction. So yes, I understand why some unionists are frustrated about where we have landed. But the fault for that lies with unionist leaders who have walked them to this position.
Yes, forget about the unionists. We don't, of course, know what you are because your party won't tell us what each of you are.
Well,
but are you frustrated that you can't dictate your own laws?
I'm a united community politician who represents people who are nationalist, who are unionist, and who are none of the above, and I'm very proud of that political identity.
You're a colonialist.
So that is what I am.
Colonialist, that's what you are.
But in terms of
you want to be governed by foreign laws you don't make.
Of course I am frustrated about where we have landed. I want Northern Ireland and the UK as a whole to be part of the UK, to be part of the EU, because that is where we can influence policy at a European level to the benefit of everyone. But I also recognise that if that isn't possible, we have to be pragmatic about the arrangements that are going to be in place. And there has been no alternative articulated by Jim or anyone else to the current arrangements that we have under the Windsor framework.
So, Jim, what do you expect the unionist parties to do?
Oh, I don't expect any unionist to vote for a condominium for Northern Ireland that were made. Laws are made in a foreign jurisdiction as well as in the United Kingdom. So I expect every unionist, it follows from the name, to oppose this outrageous proposition and to reject colonial law.
But it's going to make no
law.
Difference, is it? It's going to make no difference.
That's the point. It was designed to make no difference because it was only unionists who were bothered. If this had been the other way around, I guarantee you it would have been a cross-community vote and the Alliance Party would have been championing it. But because it's unionists who are being put down by this vote, then the colonialists and nationalists are very happy about it.
Maybe Jim, your party, and you, leading your party, have a lesson here to look at how maybe some other unionist parties behaved. If you look at the likes of Mike Nesbitt and the Ulster Unionist Party, they were against Brexit. And they warned about things like this. Owen's saying he warned about things like this as well. And you were championing Brexit. You were shouting from the rooftops. And now you're going to tell me you didn't get the Brexit that you were...
That's the dice that you rolled.
That's the Brexit.
No, that's the
gamble you took.
I voted for what it said in my ballot paper, that the United Kingdom should leave. Not that it should leave Northern Ireland behind in the EU. And that's what's happened. We've been left within their single market, subject to all their laws. We've been left within their customs code, whereas GB now is a foreign country because of their
But
customs.
If Brexit hadn't happened, that wouldn't
Brexit.
Have happened, would it? None of this.
Brexit was about taking back control. And here
and
we are, handing over control to a foreign parliament. And Owen Tennyson, great Democrat that he is, thinks that's the right thing for the voters of Upper Ban. They should have no say, no right to pass the laws that govern so much of their economy. Sorry, I disagree. And I'm the Democrat here, and he's the colonialist.
I mean, it's just nonsense, Stephen. I mean, fundamentally, what hasn't been reconciled in this debate is that a majority of people in Northern Ireland vote for parties and representatives who accept that there must be some semblance of special arrangement to manage Northern Ireland's relationship with the EU and are therefore pragmatic when it comes to the operation of the protocol.
And they're
therefore
colonialists.
And Jim is sore today because he recognises that a majority of people from right across our community in Northern Ireland actually fit into that space. So, look, I am confident that this will serve people in Upper Van well. I mean, you only have to look at ALMAC in my constituency, a highly regulated industry, which has been expanding its operation over the last number of years, in part due to the opportunities that exist under dual market access. So I'm confident that this is the right thing for everyone in Northern Ireland, whether they be nationalist, whether they be unionist, or whether they fit into neither of those boxes.
And sorry, as a Democrat, it could never be right, or nor should one be comfortable with it, that you're elected to an assembly to make the laws, and then you say, no, we don't want to make those. We want to be a colony. We want to take someone else's laws. That's not serving your constituents.
I want
That's
to ask you both.
Your constituents.
I want to ask you both before you go this morning about farmers, because subsidies paid to Northern Ireland farmers will no longer be ring-fenced. It'll have to be decided through Stormont's budget process, as you both know. This, since Brexit, the question that the farming community, I guess, would like answered this morning. Owen and Jim, Owen, we'll start with you. Do you think the same money that was ring-fenced, now no longer ring-fenced, do you think Stormont should make sure that it gets to those farmers?
I think we should endeavour to do that, yes. I'm hugely concerned that ring-fencing has been removed, because it now means about £330 million of support for the agricultural community is now going to be competing with other vital parts for public services. As
Why
part
should
of
farmers get special ring-fence treatment?
Well, this dates back, Stephen, as you will know, to our membership of the EU when under the Common Agricultural Policy there were 7-year cycles of guaranteed funding. And so this is about upholding our commitments to the agricultural community post-Brexit, and that is why the funding was originally ring-fenced by the UK government. I think it is a mistake for the UK government to have resiled from that. But again, this is one of the sorry consequences of leaving the EU, where our agricultural community has been placed in this position. There are enormous pressures on agriculture. I mean, the Climate Change Act is now in place. There needs to be a just transition. And we have to work with and support our agricultural community in order to make the changes that are needed to protect our environment.
That money is so desperately needed. That money is so desperately needed, is it not, Jim Allister, in other areas in Northern Ireland who might be, and ministers and campaigners might be thinking, hold on a minute, why should the farmers get special treatment of money ring-fenced? Could it be used, for example, to help Loch Ness? Could it be used for many other things in Northern Ireland?
Stephen, because they put the food on the table for us all. But let's be very clear about this.
So you support it being ring-fenced too, do you?
Well, I support adequate provision for our farming community. But let me just nail the lie that when you were in the EU, you were always guaranteed this. You were not. The EU worked on this 7-year cycle. There was no guarantee beyond the end of any 7-year cycle.
Well, there's no guarantee at all now.
Well, there's certainly when we left the EU, the government, the Tory government, made a commitment that at the end of the last parliament, they would ring fence, and they did. And the Labour Party, ironically, criticised them for not giving a further guarantee in that regard. Now that they're in power, they're the ones who have abandoned the guarantee. But there will be adequate funds, I suspect. Stormont this week got an extra £1.5 billion from Westminster. I don't have a lot of confidence in how they administer their funds. Sometimes they squander too much. But there certainly is money there for that purpose, and I'm sure the farmers will, and I as a representative of them, will be arguing very tenaciously for their fair share of funding. But let's also remember that under the protocol, there is a cap on what can be given to the farming community. It's a cap set by Brussels. You cannot, because of state aid rules, give your farmers more than Brussels allows you. And so even there, we're subject to the restraints of the EU.
So, Owen Tennyson, as we come to the end of this part of the chat this morning, have you and Jim bonded that you are in agreement that the farmers should get all of this money ring-fenced that they once got, the same amount ring-fenced again?
We may have found an element of common ground at last, Stephen, myself and Jim, on this issue. We do. A broken clock can be right twice a day, so occasionally myself and Jim do agree.
Well, Owen would...
Oh, Jim, reach out the hand of friendship, for goodness sake.
He'd make a much better start if he'd abandoned his colonialism and come on board as a Democrat. I would welcome him to abandon colonialism and become a Democrat. Maybe he will surprise me.
Jim Allister, Owen Tennyson, thank you very much. Here comes the news from the BBC.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Michael's in Belfast. Morning, Michael.
Hello, Stephen. How are you?
Go ahead.
I was just wondering, Mr. Tennyson there, I'm quite angry at him saying that we as in the Alliance Party want to be back as part of the single market, yet he can't answer the major question as to where he stands on a United Ireland. See, he looks for clarity in everyone else, yet hides behind that cloak all the time. All those Alliance
MPs. He is telling you, isn't he, as are many of his colleagues, that that is not the big issue for them. The constitutional question is not the big issue for them. They're not obsessed by it.
Stephen, it's the biggest issue.
And they're quite upfront about that. Well, it is for you.
It's the biggest issue in the country. No, for everyone. What do you mean for me? For everyone?
Is it?
That's the most important question in the country.
Do you think that's front and centre of everybody's minds when they get up, rather than how they're going to pay their bills? Are their kids going to go into a school building that's fit for purpose?
Look, Stephen, see, when you stand up for your beliefs, you have to take a wee bit of hurt with it.
If you're sitting on a waiting list and you've got a suspected cancer...
I don't agree with you.
If you've got a suspected cancer, do you think you're getting up in the morning and thinking, I wish this place was still UK or United Ireland or whatever? Are you thinking, what's the state of the health service?
Everybody in the country doesn't have cancer, Stephen. Everyone in the country doesn't have cancer. What are you talking about?
So why is it so important to you?
The main question is United Ireland. It's a main question in the country. And him coming out and preaching to us about part of the single market while hiding behind that cloak of indecision. It's just not right. It's just not right.
So might you vote for them if you knew where they stood?
No, never.
Who do you vote for?
Middle of the road politics doesn't work, Stephen. Middle of the road politics doesn't work.
Who do you vote for?
I vote for DUP.
Okay. And do you think the DUP has protected the union?
No. No, I don't, but it's the best of a bad bunch. I would vote for TUV, only they're not big enough. We need to see a big movement with TUV, and then I would switch. I like Jim Allister. Everything he said there to Owen Tennyson was 100% true. He's a good man, Jim. No matter what you think about him, his position doesn't change, Stephen. He's the same view now as what he had 20 years ago. That's what I like.
Michael, thank you. Good morning to you. 030-30-80-55-55. We were talking about the farmers earlier on. William Irvine's president of the Ulster Farmers Union. Tell me why you're so concerned, William. Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. Yeah, well, this has been a very difficult budget for agriculture as a whole, Stephen. We had the body blow about the agricultural property relief, and now this follow-up where there's no longer any guarantee or surety around our future farm support payments. So agriculture is reeling a bit about these two issues just as we speak. Agriculture is a generational business with investments made for generations, very long-term investments, and we require some security as to our income. And I should say, too, that the reason that agriculture has been supported over the years is to reduce the cost of the food to the consumers. So while I fully appreciate that many consumers struggle with their weekly shop, the cost of food does not fully compensate us for the cost of production. And that's why the support was in place over the years.
But you're saying, William, that you have no guarantees. Stormont could give you that guarantee. Stormont could ring fence the money. So it's not that you can't have it. It's you're up for grabs now with Stormont.
Well, we are. And actually, the mood music coming out of Stormont is quite positive. They actually debated agricultural support back on the 7th of this month, 7th of October. And they... all the parties right around the piece were very supportive in recognising that agriculture needed secured funding. And our minister...
So what are you worried about?
We would just like that closed down and guaranteed. It's an uncertainty that no business likes uncertainty, and this combined with the agricultural property relief tobacco has seriously rattled the confidence of our membership and agriculture industry as a whole.
Well, look, the political parties can release statements. We'll contact them this morning if we haven't already, and we'll ask them, are they giving a public, the likes of the DUP, the likes of Sinn Féin, are they giving a public commitment to you now to alleviate any of that worry? But I'll tell you what, they give that commitment, they ring-fence that money, it means someone else isn't getting it, that desperately needs it too.
Yeah, I realise there's many demands within Northern Ireland, but the agricultural industry and what it does for Northern Ireland and what it does for food security of the United Kingdom is central to our rural communities here and actually central to the whole of society for the UK. We over the years have been not successful at producing a value food. People take the provision of that food as a given, and it is not a given. It's a huge industry, works very hard to provide it. It requires big investment, big family commitment in most cases to deliver it, and that's why we are so nervous that this is even being debated.
Now, so what's going to happen if you don't get the money?
Well, it's going to reduce farmers' ability to invest in the future. And this big ask being made at the minute about of agriculture as a whole to address climate problems and all the rest of it. And we have a future support system in the process of being rolled out. That this journey started back in the previous administration, and all credit to our current minister. He is continuing the process. And this future support is all about delivering change and creating efficiencies which help the environment and help carbon capture and all of that. But that requires the funding to deliver.
William, thanks for coming on this morning. Thank you. Fred, morning, Fred.
Hello there. How are you doing, Steve?
Go ahead, Fred.
No, they were talking about the Windsor framework. I had to go into the chemist the other day. I'd been hospitalised for a few days, and I had to go to pick up a prescription. And there's a note on the counter that said that due to various restrictions on medicines, some of these medicines will be hard to get, and maybe have to be a long waiting period. And we know this has already happened, as Mr. Irvine has already said there, in agriculture, some of the things are not can't even be got, and there are some other facilities that farmers are going to be ruled completely out. They will not be able even to get them at all. And this is all due to EU regulation.
Who do you blame?
Well, I suppose those that negotiated the framework. After all, Dave, we can see what it cost Jeffrey Donaldson. He said everything was going to be all right when it wasn't all right. And now the current leader of the DUP has said, oh yes, we weren't told the right things. So how do you have trust in someone you can't trust? They say one thing one day and then they say, no, we didn't mean that at all. We meant something else. And they told exactly something that wasn't true. And this has been highlighted in the press for quite some time. And EU laws, it was bad enough when we were in the EU laws, but the problem is that our local politicians don't really have a great interest in agriculture, even though it is the main industry in the country.
I'm sure lots of them would disagree with you there. Lots of the different politicians would disagree with you, would you? And they say they represent the farming community.
Pardon?
Fred, thank you. Good morning. Thank you for coming on this morning. 20 to 10, 0, 30, 30, 80, 55, 55. Bucklers off to the States. We look forward to him being on the Nolan Show and across BBC News NI, I think is the corporate line.
A second Trump term would be a huge risk for America and dangerous.
She's destroying this country, and if she becomes president, this country doesn't have a chance of success.
Next week, America decides who should be its next president. and Good Morning Ulster will be broadcasting live from the States, hearing the views of voters as Kamala Harris takes on Donald Trump.
We're here to support that man. And we just got stronger in our determination to do it.
I'm reinforced in my belief that he is an existential threat to our democracy.
It's a shame that my vote counts the same as your vote.
It's a shame that you aren't in the same reality that we are.
And it remains a close, contentious, and controversial campaign.
They're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats.
Talk about extreme.
The US election. Full coverage across BBC News NI. And join me, Chris Buckler, for Good Morning Ulster, live from America, every morning next week on BBC Radio Ulster and anytime on BBC Sounds.
Now, the killing of one cat, severe beating of a number of other cats in the Carrickfergus area over recent days, has led to the PSNI appealing for information. Vets have confirmed the injuries were inflicted by humans. The incidents have led to the USPCA offering a reward of £500 to anyone who can give information that leads to a successful conviction. Nora Smith from the USPCA has been speaking to me, and I began by asking her to tell me what is happening with these cats.
Yes, horrendous case. We read about it in the media where a number of cats have been attacked. One sadly has died due to the injuries it sustained, and obviously whenever we read about it we wanted to help. So what we have done is we issued a reward for £500 to encourage any member of the public that may have a vital piece of information to come forward to help the police with their investigations. You know, from our perspective, animal abuse is never something that should be tolerated, and it's important that we send out a really loud and clear message that by committing such horrendous acts that, you know, we completely condemn them, and ultimately we want to see who's responsible, that they're brought to justice.
And so do you know what happened to the actual, is this one cat or the... There have been other cats, haven't there?
Yeah, there have been several cats. The media report, we haven't been speaking to the police directly on this case. Several cats that have been severely beaten, and one sadly died due to the injuries that it sustained. And this was done over a two-day period in Carrickfergus.
Beaten with what?
Well, the local veterinary report, post-mortem, had said that the injuries were sustained by... human contact. So we don't know the specifics. We can only assume that it was either some kind of instrument that they used, or potentially
Someone do that?
I don't know. It's very difficult to comprehend how anybody would ever deliberately inflict injury or harm onto an innocent animal. They don't have a voice. They can't protect themselves. So from our perspective, it's our job as the USPCA to speak up for them whenever they can. So when we read this case, it particularly hit a chord with us, and we just wanted to do something. We wanted to support the police with their investigation, and we hope that through this reward that it will incentivise anybody who may have that vital piece of information just to come forward to help the police with their investigation.
How much animal cruelty is there in Northern Ireland compared to elsewhere in the UK? How do we stack up?
Yeah, it's very difficult to get, you know, up to date statistics on it. We do know, unfortunately, through, you know, the increase in cases coming into ourselves has increased substantially, and we're getting reports from, you know, other rescues and centres across Northern Ireland that they're being inundated with animals that are coming into them as well. Unfortunately, across the UK, animal cruelty does appear to be increasing. Now, it could be that more people are reporting cases, which is a positive step forward, but ultimately it raises the questions about why would anybody harm an innocent animal in this world.
And did you say there, Nora, did I pick this up right, that you are seeing an increase in cases in Northern Ireland of animal cruelty coming to the USPCA? Significant increase?
Significant, sadly, yeah. You know, so this year alone, we've seen a 64% increase in the number of stray and abandoned dogs that have come into us. A lot of those are severe welfare cases, dogs that have been severely neglected, in some cases abused. Now, the resilience of these animals is incredible. You know, with veterinary care and with some TLC, They are, the majority of them, then do go on to find their forever homes. But it's just deeply frustrating when we see these cases coming through, and ultimately what we want to see are, is, you know, we've been saying for such a long time, we need to see a better enforcement model in Northern Ireland when it comes to animal cruelty cases. And what we want to see are the cases that do make it to the courts, that in the most severe cases, that they feel the full weight of the law. You know, we've got good laws in Northern Ireland, good legislation, sentencing legislation that changed in 2016. But unfortunately, sometimes when cases go to courts, it just feels like they're getting a slap on the wrist. So it raises the question about what or who is deterring these individuals and these groups from inflicting such acts of cruelty.
A 64% increase in stray abandoned dogs, many of them abused, neglected. In what way
You know, there's one case comes to mind. Rosa, a wee boxer that came into us last year. She was brought into us after being thrown out of a moving car. She was severely underweight. Absolute miracle that she didn't break any bones. But her resilience and her trust in humans after that act was just miraculous. She's such a brilliant dog, such a loving dog, and is now living her dream life in her new forever home. And that's what keeps us sane whenever we get these cases in, and whenever we're able to turn around their lives and we get the photographs and the videos through from their new families where these dogs and cats are living the lives that they all should be living. But unfortunately, you know, we say this all the time, you know, how well or how badly we treat our animals is in all of our hands. So it's really important that as a society, whenever these horrific acts happen, like this case in Carrickfergus at the weekend, that we as a society, we as a community all stand up and do what we can to ensure that whoever was responsible for it is ultimately brought to justice. And that has sent out a really loud and clear message that anybody else who's contemplating doing such horrific acts, that they're stopped in their tracks.
And also, if we circle back finally to that story about the cats, there's someone out there in our society, and if they're prepared to do that to animals, what are they prepared to do to humans as well?
Yeah,
we need to find this person.
We do, absolutely. You know, and there's been lots of research done in relation to people that inflict, you know, violence and cruelty on animals, and the relationship then with the bigger one to do, unfortunately, to with other cases, you know, on a separate note but related. You know, we launched a report nearly 2 years ago now on badger baiting in Northern Ireland, and these are individuals that send, you know, dogs down sets and, you know, pit dogs against badgers. And From what we have seen for those individuals, you know, they have a portfolio of crimes, you know, paramilitarism, drugs, domestic violence. So, you know, these are, in some cases, scary individuals, and it's really important that, from our perspective in the USPCA, that we're providing a voice for innocent animals that unfortunately are feeling the brunt of these individuals. They think that they're this right to inflict cruelty on innocent animals.
Nora, thanks very much for speaking to us this morning. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, the PACE and I are appealing for information. 101 is the number. You can quote serial reference number 1213 if you have any information. Right, rates relief. The Chancellor announced a 40% rates relief scheme. Independent retailers and other high street businesses in England. This is a continuation of what's been happening in England. We get that money, this Barnett consequential. Barnett consequential basically means what happens in England. We get our slice of that here in Northern Ireland. And we've been getting our slice to contribute towards rates relief for businesses for quite a long time. The only thing is the Stormont Executive have been deciding to use the money for other things rather than give it to business. And in the budget, Rachel Reeves announced the continuation of this 40% rates relief for independent retailers, other high street businesses in England. And so many of the local businesses here in Northern Ireland are thinking, well, Stormont, you're getting the money. You're actually getting the money for this being sent to you from England. So why aren't you giving it to us? Glenn Roberts, Chief Exec of Retail NI. Morning, Glenn.
Morning, Stephen.
And you're not getting it. Your members aren't getting it because Stormont's deciding they're bigger priorities and they're not giving it to you.
Well, I think, Stephen, you set the situation out very well. And let's put it in this context. Our members pay the most expensive business rates anywhere in the UK by a country mile. We didn't get the 75% reduction that independent retailers and other high street businesses got in England. We didn't get a single penny of that. Instead, what we got was increases in the regional rate and the local rate. And we've requested to meet with the finance minister, discuss this situation, because why should independent retailers in Bolton or Bradford get 40% off their rates bill, but independent retailers and high street businesses in Ballymena or Belfast or Ballymoney not get it? So and we're going to be hit a bit of a double whammy here, because we've got to absorb, our members have got to absorb the national insurance hike, which will have a huge impact on local jobs and local businesses, and not get the 40% rates holiday or rates relief that other businesses in the UK are getting. So it's a very, very simple message to Stormont, is they need to ensure that there's a level playing field when it comes to rates across the UK.
Well, you heard probably Jim and Owen this morning, Jim Alistair, Owen Tennyson, they're talking about how the farmer's subsidy, Stormont should protect that. We can't protect everything, and this is going to be about priorities. And if you've survived without it up to now, maybe you can continue to survive without it. Might be the harsh but realistic message in some of our politicians who have to decide this.
Well, that's the point. Many businesses are not surviving this. We have the highest shop vacancy rate in the UK by a country mile. Our high streets are facing huge challenges, and we need to ensure that we get this 40% rates relief, which gives our members more of an opportunity to reinvest that money, reinvest their own money back into the high street, creating more jobs and growing our economy. So that's what we want to do. It's a very simple message. And let me say this, that if you look at the Chancellor says that she wants, her agenda is all about growth in the economy. If that's the case, why then do you put such a huge burden with this national insurance increase? And also, if Stormont and the executive is very clear about what they want to do in terms of growth, they have got to address this dead hand of business rates, which is destroying jobs, it's crippling businesses, and it's holding back economic growth.
Have you lobbied before about this? What did they say before? The limit, by the way, the cap is 110 grand, isn't it?
Yes,
so it's not
right.
It's not the massive big brand conglomerates that would benefit from this. What have they said to you before in Stormont?
Well, they've said that they have other priorities. I understand that obviously the finance minister is looking at this issue of business rates. We've put a request into Meter to discuss the UK budget and indeed where we are with business rates. And Stephen, like, I'm not asking for anything else that other businesses in the UK don't have. I'm not asking for any special circumstances or opt-outs. I'm only asking for the same situation that independent retailers have in England. And our members are asking, why is this not the case? Why are we being treated differently in Northern Ireland? And as I've said, we have the highest shop vacancy rate. Our high streets are really, really struggling. So we need to ensure that our members can keep more of their money to reinvest in the economy and create those new jobs. That's how you get growth. You don't clobber businesses with tax and exorbitant business rates. And, you know, I have members tell me that they feel that they're just working to pay their rates bill. I'm sorry, that's unacceptable.
What the Chancellor's actually done is she's cut the relief from 75% to 40%. So England, we're getting 75%. That's been cut to 40%, but it's 40% more than anybody's getting here.
Absolutely. And we got that money. The money was redirected into other parts of the budget within the executive. So I think what we're asking us for is at the very least that we get that 40% this time, because our members have to absorb that huge burden of that national insurance hike. We've also got significant increases in the living wage.
So diverted away. And look, I know this is an easy thing for me to say, and I'm not trying to be facetious or glib, because you could say this about any industry, but divert it away from where? Divert it away from health? Divert the money away from education so that your members get it? Divert it away from helping domiciliary care workers be able to get a fair wage? Where do you divert this money away from, Glenn?
Well, it's not about that. I have no doubt that health will get a decent settlement out of this. Maybe not enough, but certainly better than what they were. I think in politics, it's all about making the tough decisions. And what we're saying is that if you want to grow our economy, create jobs, which in turn helps fund our health and education system, then clobbering business with exorbitant rates, bills, national insurance increases is not the way to do it. So what you've got to do is grow the economy. When you grow the economy, that means you're going to help fund greater funding settlements into our health and education, public services. We're very, very conscious of that. And another point as well, that the Chancellor said that this budget will not impact on working people. Many of my members are working people who struggle themselves to take income out of the business. And I think so it's very important that we put this into context. We just
are
don't
we
have
not,
the cost.
For all of those, sorry to cut across you, but for all of those political parties, you know, the unionist parties who have been demanding the same treatment, no border, Narrow Sea, and all that goes with it, as elsewhere in the UK, I haven't heard them scream from the rooftops about this. Are they with you in this?
Well, ourselves, Hospitality Ulster, and other business groups have been very, very clear about this.
Yeah, but where's the DUP, the UUP, the TUV on this difference between England and Northern Ireland for all the small businesses in Northern Ireland?
Well, we have been very clear about this in our submission to the programme or government consultation. We've outlined a number of ways which we could retrofit the rating system. But I think we've a very, very clear ask here from Stormont Executive. You will be getting this money through the Barnett Consequential. We want what England has. We want to ensure that that money gets to independent retailers and other high street businesses so they can grow their business, create new jobs. And that's the way that we move our economy forward. And let me say this. It isn't just a cost of living crisis which we face. It is a cost of doing business crisis, which has been made a lot worse by this UK budget. And we need to ensure that government at all levels is pulling all the stops to support local small businesses, local independent retailers.
I have 1 minute before the news. Are you optimistic? I know we've talked a lot about traffic chaos and things. Are you optimistic heading towards Christmas shopping season here?
Well, I think, as I've said on your show, we need to. It's good that the 25th of November is the moratorium. What we need to see is that brought forward, because Christmas shopping, because working families spread the cost of Christmas earlier, they're starting earlier every year. So what we'd like to see is that congestion moratorium brought forward by a few weeks to make sure that people can get in and out of high streets and town centres. We don't have the congestion.
Okay.
You know, we want to see the hub successful. We want to see the Sydney bypass sorted, but let's move that moratorium forward.
Okay, Glenn, thanks very much. Thank you.
The Stephen Nolan Show.
Did I hear that right? The Shadow Secretary of State. Do we need to do a whip round for him? What's it cost to fly from London to Belfast? If you book ahead, you probably get it for 40 or 50 or 60 quid, right? Let's even say 100 quid. The Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland can't afford to fly. Did I hear that right? He was speaking to Camus this morning. Let's just hear this again.
This is something that I wanted to do, and if there had been the money available to do it, I very much would have done. It's been very annoying for me that I haven't been able to come. But I'm sure you'll appreciate.
Had there been the money available,
I've been involved with politicians.
Had there been the money available to do it? Had there been the money available to do it, Mr. Burkhardt, you cannot afford to fly to Northern Ireland and back and get a hotel. Is that right? The Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. Are we important enough? What would that trip cost? Even coming in and out in the same day? A couple hundred quid? Are we important enough to you, Mr. Burkhardt? Do the people of Northern Ireland need to do a whip round? Will we all throw 10p into the pot? And are we serious at the situation now were a party that was the government until just a few weeks ago, is saying they cannot afford to fly into Northern Ireland. Like, we're not Timbuktu, are we? We're not Australia. What is going on? You let me know what you think. 030-30-80-55-55. Let's look next at the GAA president, Charlotte Burns. He says Casement Park will be redeveloped but will now cost significantly less. Secretary of State Hilary Benn said yesterday on Good Morning Ulster, any extra funding for Casement Park is now an issue for Stormont.
The Northern Ireland Executive has just been given quite a bit of additional money. And Casement Park is a Northern Ireland Executive project. Now the Euros have gone, and it is for the Northern Ireland Executive to decide how to take it forward.
So how should they decide? The Secretary of State very much putting it up to Stormont now. Mr. Burns met with the Communities Minister, Gordon Lyons, yesterday. Sports within Gordon's brief. Following the meeting, Charlotte Burns spoke to our reporter, Kevin Sharkey, and said the proposed development of Casement Park will be downsized, but it will still cater for more than 30,000 fans.
We are still looking at a capacity of over 30,000. We can still do that with a more basic and modest fit-out, because we think that it is very important that although we get our stadium, which is part of obviously the stadium strategy and the infrastructure strategy and the programme for government priorities, that we do so in a responsible way. And we have managed to retain the number of people who will fit into it while having it to a lower specification.
Okay, so still over 30,000. The other key aspect now is how much can the cost be reduced to, ideally?
I don't want to get into specific costs now, Kevin, because obviously we are hoping that it's going to go out to tender soon. I don't think that would be helpful.
Will any money be put towards the project by the British government? Dan Marshall was pressing the Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, who said that while there was a certain amount of money that could be made available, the costs for the revised plan need to be declared.
This has been a long-standing commitment of the executive to ensure that Casement Park gets built, but we need to take it a stage at a time, and I look forward to hearing more about what this revised stadium looks like.
Okay, you want to see this revised plan? It received planning permission in 2021. It's a 34,000-seater capacity GAA stadium. That's the plan. What more do you need to see from the GAA? And you quoted Charlotte Burns. Charlotte Burns also said, closing the funding gap is in the hands of the executive and the Treasury. So let's ditch the riddles. You're in office 4 months now. Will there be a UK government Treasury contribution to Casement Park? Yes or no?
Well, you say that you know what the alternative proposition looks like. That hasn't been shared with me yet.
It received planning permission 3 years ago. It's in the public domain, a 34,500 capacity GAA stadium.
I know, but the fact is the Euros has gone as a possibility, as you'll be well aware, and there is a certain amount of money in the kitty. The question is, what kind of stadium can be afforded for the money that is there and additional funds that might be made available? Now, the executive has choices to make about this. I've been very clear in saying I am not in a position to give a commitment at the moment. The Prime Minister said he wanted to see what the alternative proposition looks like. You appear to know what it is. I would like to know what it is, and I'd like to know what price tag attaches to it. Do you know what the price tag is?
Is the door open to providing money then?
Pardon?
So the door is open to providing money when you get...
Well, I would like to know what the cost of this revised proposition is. And I look forward to hearing from the executive and from the GEA as to precisely what it is. But at the moment, it appears to be a very, very large gap.
I like that man, Darren Marshall, who was asking those questions. Ditch the riddles, he said to the Secretary of State. I like his form, actually. But the Secretary of State is saying, look, tell us how much it's going to cost. Commentator, former SLP Special Advisor Brendan Mulgrew. Hello, Brendan.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, and the TV Councillor Ron McDowell. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Stephen. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, good morning. Like, Brendan, can Stormont possibly even begin to make a decision? Can Gordon Lyons even begin to make a decision without being told how much it's going to cost?
Well, there's a couple of things that need to happen in parallel, Stephen, in order to finally get work started on Casement. Yes, we need to determine what the cost is going to be of a, as Charlotte Burns said yesterday, a more modest stadium now that the UEFA is off the table. The specifications, the whistles and the bells that went along with the UEFA, they're all gone now. So we need to find to get the funding gap and the source of funding, but at the same time, we need to begin the process of putting the job out to tender, because that's the ultimate way we're going to find out how much it costs. When developers and those who are expert in building stadia come back and say, well, you want to build a 30,000-seater, here's your specifications, here's how much it's going to cost. So there's no reason both of those things can't happen. In fact, they should happen at the same time. So there's an onus on the Department for Community.
Sorry, what should happen at the same time?
That the process of putting the job out to tender should happen as we are finalising the discussions around the funding gap and who is going to meet it.
But we can't put it out to tender. Correct me if I'm wrong here. But surely it can't be put out to tender until we know what the spec is.
Well, actually,
so when we say this is reduced, reduced to what?
But ultimately, Stephen, it's putting it out to tender with the specifications that's going to tell us. We can all make estimates, and architects and stadium designers can get involved and say it's going to be in this ballpark, it might cost this or that. But it's when the developer says, I can build a stadium you're looking for X. That's when we know the actual cost. And we need to be in a position to...
But can you help me with the basics around this? So the GAA are saying that this new stadium, this new proposal for a stadium, should still cater for 30,000 fans. Why 30,000? Why not 20,000? Why not 40,000? But a rolled back spec.
Okay.
Why are they fixed in this figure of 30,000?
Because it's not a new stadium, Stephen. And Darren Marshall was quite right to point out to the Secretary of State yesterday, who, to be fair to Hilary Benn, I think, had been badly briefed by his own people. This stadium has received planning consent as long ago as at least 3 years ago. It received this planning consent. We know the type of, we know the size of stadium that we are dealing with here. It is 30,000 plus. It is there's an element in it which is terracing. The majority of it is seats. It was when the UEFA came along, and it was the British government who dangled the prospect of Caisson Park hosting European Games. It was then that UEFA said, well, no, we need all seaters.
Yeah, but that was a different British government. My point is this.
It was a different
British government 3 years ago. Is there not a need to, or should there not be a need to look at it and say, okay, we're 3 years in, we're a new government, what should it be now?
Given
the financial position the country's in, the hard choices the executive's got to make.
I get all that.
What should it be now, rather than this was 3 years ago, therefore that's it?
No,
decided.
Stephen, I get all that. It's important to finish the point that there was one British government dangled the Euros and there was another one that took it away. The GA didn't do either of those two things. But that put a 3 year delay into the project, in which time the costs have gone up. So I don't think the British government can be excused from their obligation to make a further contribution to the development of Caisson Park, as Jarlath Industry, a more modest Caisson Park.
And Councillor Romick, though, the bottom line is this: costs are going to continue to go up. They're hardly going to come down. So therefore, should Northern Ireland PLC not get on with building this stadium, it's going to be cheaper now than if this drags out for a year or two.
Well, it's just another episode in the debacle, which is Caisson Park. That you can present a stadium with no costing, that you can present a stadium with no plans, that you can present a stadium based on a nod and a wink and expect...
Well, there are plans because planning permission was given. You don't get planning permission without plans.
Planning permission has been given, but we now hear that it's a modified plan, that it's less glamorous, that it has less of a capacity. So where's the plans for this? No one knows what Caisson Park's going to look like.
They're rolling back from the UEFA project, the UEFA proposal, aren't they?
They're not rolling
back from the initial plans.
The UEFA project was up to £400 million. That was the rolling costs. Now they've rolled back from that, but they've rolled back to what position? We don't know. Now, I have to say, the primary position of TUV would be that any money should be withheld to press for reform within the GAA. To make it more palatable and to all strands of unionism, to make it sport for all, to improve its inclusiveness. But living in the reality of Northern Ireland, I'm really interested in what Jarlath Burns said a few minutes ago when you played that quote from him, when he said he came out of a meeting with Gordon Lyons and now said they're going out to tender. So what promises did the DUP's Gordon Lyons give Jarlath Burns around Caisson Park? And we don't know. We don't know what the new stadium's going to look like. We don't know what it's how many it's going to hold. There's just so many unanswered questions around this. It's really, really amateurish, and we need more detail on it.
Well, it's completely coherent to say you don't want to make a costing public if you're going out to a tendering process. It's completely logical to say that because you're trying to get people to tender at the best price to the public purse possible so you don't reveal your hand. What bit of that do you not get?
So this is public money. We all have an estimation. So
for more reason to get it as cheap as possible then.
Any budgeting that's going to come out of Stormont has to be costed. All of the stadium and all the stages of Casement Park so far has been costed with an estimate. There was an estimate of 67 million, an estimate of 125 million, and we had estimates of 315 million, an estimate of 400 million, and now we're told, don't worry, it'll be all right. It'll not be as dear as that. That's not good enough. We now have a block grant coming again, and an improved block grant coming from Westminster. The stadium, the Euros stadium is now gone. It's off the table. It's now a competitive process again. There should be equal funding, and that's what we'll be looking for. Obviously, we can't, given the demographics of Stormont, deliver on our primary position. But secondary, we would be looking that any money coming in a block grant towards sport in Northern Ireland would be handed out in a competitive process and equally between all the sports in Northern Ireland who need the money just as much
as
the
DAA. Well, soccer and rugby have had their stadium built, haven't they?
They have had their stadium built for a minuscule amount of money compared to what the new GAA stadium is meant to be. It's an eye-watering at the minute. The only figure we have, even though we're told it's rolled back, the only figure we have at the minute for the GAA is £400 million.
And Brendan Mulgrew, London, at the end of the day, did not help pay one penny for soccer or rugby. Why should GAA get a lot more from London?
On that point, Stephen, the £400 million figure came... It was a verbal figure stated by Hillary Benn. No one's ever seen it written down. Where was the business case that showed 400 million? That figure came out of nowhere a month ago. It wasn't signed up to by the GAA or anyone else. So it's not the only figure that's out there. And you see the point about the British government didn't contribute to the cost of Windsor Park and of Kingspan. Belfast City Council didn't build those stadiums. You know, where does Northern Ireland get its money from? Ultimately, it all comes from the UK Treasury. So, yes, there was UK government involved in building those funds. Be it through the block grant. That's how this place is funded. We don't fund ourselves.
Well, okay, so be it through the block grant, given all the pressures there are, what are you saying, how the political parties who would need to vote for this should weigh this up?
I'm saying that at the minute there is about roughly 120 or 125 million pounds on the table to redevelop Casement Park. If we go with a more modest proposal, now the UEFA project has disappointingly been taken off the table, and the figure is going to be something within, if it's going to be around 200 million pounds, for example, then we've got a funding gap. And there are four parties to the discussions around how to resolve that funding gap: the GAA, the Northern Ireland Executive, the two governments, the British government and the Irish government. And I think that those conversations, I hope that yesterday was the beginning of a round of conversations when the GAA met with Gordon Lyons and, you know, the new...
Well, we need to hear... We need to hear Gordon Lyons' account, don't we? We need to hear our minister's account of what how he believes that meeting went.
Yeah.
Final word to you, Ron.
And I think everything in Northern Ireland has to be comparative and it has to be a fair process. When Ulster Rugby got the Ravenhill done up, it cost them around 12, 16 million pounds. I can't remember the exact figure, but it was a relatively small amount. The GAA has almost cost that already for Casement Park in failed plans, failed development, and a failed project. Let's strip it back. Let's make it fair. Let's look at all of sport in Northern Ireland.
Well, you can hardly call it a failed project if it hasn't started yet.
A failed project, Stephen, that is a project that has been on the table for decades now. Decades. And they haven't broke soil on it yet. It has been a disaster from the start.
Why aren't you of the mind, help them break soil? Help them get a stadium which is going to attract people into that community, jobs, help young people play sport, learn sport, enjoy sport, the concerts, the big gigs that could be in that local area. Help them break soil.
And I am helping them. I'm telling them what they need to do. I'm reaching out the hand to them. They need to improve their philosophy of sport for all. I've already said that. They need to improve their inclusiveness. They need to be an organisation without hindrance or barrier to anybody in community who can who wants to play GAA sports. So that's what they need to do. They need to do, and they need to ingratiate themselves, come in from the cold,
okay,
make themselves welcome and to everyone.
Brendan, thank you very much. Thank you, Councillor McDowell, as well, for coming on this morning. Next up, what about your kids being banned from using Twitter and Facebook and social media? The Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, recently announced plans for a social media ban for children there. The law would put Australia among the first countries in the world to impose an age restriction on social media. Should we be looking at this in the UK? Commentators Dermot Hamill, Emma Wolfe joining us. I began by asking Emma what she thought of the move.
Absolutely. And you say, should some young children? I think all young children, and actually children and young people under the age of 16, should be banned from using social media, should be banned from smartphones, and should be banned from going online. I don't think there is anything positive about the internet nowadays.
Well, they might.
For children. No, actually, overwhelmingly, the research now, not only parents, but if you speak to young people, you will find increasingly they recognise the addiction, the stress, the anxiety, the nastiness of the world that they've been sucked into. They are fed up with it.
There are also benefits. There are also benefits of connecting with the world, reading what other people are saying.
That's what we say. That's what we've always said. When we had a childhood pre-internet, we had people out. We had children and young people outdoors. We didn't have the levels of obesity. We didn't have the levels of ADHD, learning difficulties, concentration difficulties. We didn't have the anxiety and the depression. Children, we have some of the most unhappy, some of the fattest, and some of the most myopic. Do you realize these addictions to smartphones are actually affecting children's eyesight? The levels of blindness from children literally being indoors, in their bedrooms, staring at screens. From every perspective, we need to get control of this. There's nothing, of course, Stephen, after 16, of course, children, adults are going to be online for the rest of their lives. But you do not need that when you are under 16.
Well, Dermot, when you were 16, you launched a youth politics podcast, of course.
I did, yes. And it's what has gotten me into commentary now. So I think, you know, the access to social media was the only thing that made that possible. I mean, so much of, and particularly, you know, access to online, being able to send emails to politicians is what made it happen, being able to promote it online. And it got young people involved in politics. It got young people interested in politics. And I think while, yes, there's certainly an argument to be made about, you know, for young children. But I think, you know, whenever you're looking at kind of that bracket between, say, 14 and 16, I think, you know, it's so important for being able to, you know, to connect with friends, to be able to, you know, using just, I mean, on the point of the internet, just being able to use it as a massive research tool in schools nowadays. And I think it's just not really fair to kind of force this on every child. I mean, look at how different young people mature. I think that's a parental decision rather than anything else, and I think that's something parents should be doing. I think the oversight should be there rather than putting it on to big tech or the government. I think that this shouldn't be a state issue. This should be a parental issue, and that's where we really need to examine our priorities. If a parent thinks that the child should be allowed in social media at, say, 15, I think that's fine. But if they don't, then they don't. But
Dermot, with respect, people started up fantastic youth movements, political movements in the old days when we could write letters to politicians, when we could make phone calls. That did actually happen in the old days before you did research online. Guess what? You went to libraries, you looked things up in encyclopedias. Education levels were much, much higher pre-internet. As for connecting with other people, guess what? We had friends before we had the internet. We didn't have the levels of bullying. So there was all of that. There was friendship. There were youth political movements, there was research, there was education and learning and fun and play before the internet. Children do not need this. They have the rest of their lives to do what we do, which is stare at our blooming phones all day. Honestly, and I'm bringing up a four-year-old, completely screen-free, TV-free, smartphone-free, internet-free, and it is hard. And of course,
how old are they, Emma?
My little one is four. And of course, the pressure is going to only mount. It is very, very difficult. But when I explain to you the pressures on parents, of course, it comes down to parents. You make a choice what your children eat. You make a choice how they live, where they live, you know, whether they use social media, whatever. But the fact is, when you have every other child at a school who has smartphones, I mean, I know 2 and 3-year-olds, Stephen, that wake up in the morning and reach for a tablet. I mean, and it would be easy. It's a wonderful electronic babysitter. shove your children in front of cartoons, shove them in front of the internet, job done.
Dermot.
And it's hard.
I think ultimately, you know, yes, of course, it probably is hard, but that's because the internet is, you know, as far as in terms of
addictive
information, you know, it absolutely is addictive. But it's the greatest information tool that the world has ever seen and could even conceptualize. So you can't. I think the idea of
libraries are the greatest.
Let's let Dermot finish. Hold on.
I think, you know, if you take that idea of a suggestion up to 16, well, what are we going to do? Have 16-year-olds and then the next day they have access to all the information in human history? You know, that, I think that's kind of ridiculous. You know, the internet runs everything we do. It, you know, our trains, for example, are run by social media, are run by the internet. I mean, like, I buy my tickets on my phone. Like, I think that, you know, there are silly little things like that that you really have to look at. You know,
yeah, we went to ticket offices before that. It is possible, honestly. I know you don't believe me, but it's possible to live before the internet was invented 20 years ago. It really is. And of course, we can quibble about the age, whether it's 16 or 14 or 17 or 18 or how you do that transition. I agree with you. You don't wait till their 16th birthday and then give them these amazing smartphones into their hand. There's plenty of education about internet safety and all of that. But honestly, I know you don't believe me, but we did buy tickets for trains. And we did have friends. We did go to libraries before the internet.
Talking down to the young man, is, I know that stick might work for you here, Anna. But really and truly, when we look at, you know, the conveniences of the internet, why would we take a societal step back for our young people? I mean, I grew up using social media. I grew up during the pandemic. We didn't. We weren't able to go outside to make friends. We couldn't go out into libraries. You know, what about if that happens again? We're just going to say, no, you have no access to information. You're going to sit in your house and you're going to kick a football against your wall. I know because of the internet, have friends right across the world who I've met because of my comments.
But what's wrong with waiting to 16 to do it?
Because I think I was a young man who developed and matured at a different level to other 16-year-olds around me. I thought my parents believed I was someone that could be trusted with that too. And I think it should be my parents' decision, and it should be a parental decision. I think this idea of the nanny state stepping in and saying, no, young man, you can't have access to Google, or you can't have access to Facebook.
It's not that.
It's ridiculous.
Dermot, with respect, firstly, I'm not an older person. Secondly, I'm talking down to
older,
you.
Older than
it's
me.
It's just that you're focusing on the benefits, and I've acknowledged the benefits, but I'm focusing on the harms. I am focusing on the harms. I'm asking, why do we have a generation who are more anxious, more depressed, more addicted to smartphones? When you look at the grooming, when you look at the bullying and the pornography and the violence online, it's not a place, okay? If the internet was a physical space, it is not a place as a parent of a young child where you would let your child play unrestricted. And of course, it's parental decision. And I agree with you on that wholeheartedly. And you sound like you used it really responsibly and your parents had oversight. That is really hard. Security tools, you know, setting those security parameters. Kids are smart. They get around them. You know, you block one thing or you limit their screen time and they get around it. So it's hard. And I'm just saying the harms outweigh the benefits.
Final word to you, Dermot.
I think, you know, the restrictions are in place that we can use. And I think, yes, I will concede that restrictions on social media from social media companies need to be stronger. I'll absolutely concede that. But ultimately, this is a point of parental oversight and should not be the case of the state having to do parents' jobs.
Dermot and Emma, it's really interesting.
Thank you
very much indeed. Thank you. And thank you, too, for listening this week. I'm on 5 Live all weekend. We start tonight, 10 o'clock across the UK. But from us here at Radio Ulster, we'll see you back Monday morning. Have a good weekend, and thanks very much as always.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.